Order. Time is 1:40. Today's March 2nd. We have with us Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Co-Chairman Schultz, myself, Co-Chairman Meyer, Vice Chair Stokes, Representative Hocker, Representative Wyrock, and Representative Moses will not be here today. Okay, on this afternoon's schedule, we have three bills, House Bill 395, fire season start date. That's a continuation from bill we heard last week. House Bill 394, insurance policies in foreign languages, and House Bill 321, aggravated drunk driving. So, with that, let's go right to House Bill 395. The sponsors want to come up. We need a motion, though. We got a CS here.
Mr. Chairman, I make the motion that we adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 395, version 24-LS1550/F, bullock, dated 3-2 of 06, as a working document before the committee.
Okay, any objections? Seeing none, then we have that CS in front of us. And it's my understanding, Conrad, you're going to explain the changes.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Conrad Jackson. Staff to, excuse me, Representative Kurt Olson. Before he was the CS for House Bill 395, it does a couple of things. The easy one adds an immediate effective date in hopes that we can have this in place and take care of this year's fire season. The other change is a change to the end of the fire season. Basically, instead of adding a month to the beginning and extending the fire season, we're adding a month to the beginning, as the original bill said, and removing a month from the end. Thereby, the fire season stays the same length. It's just 1 month earlier. By doing that, DNR has zeroed out the fiscal note to help with that. There is apparently a conceptual amendment for the title, since the original title still says the title says extending the period of fire season. This CS does not actually extend the fire season; it just changes the fire season. So, I believe your staff, Suzanne Cunningham, has a conceptual amendment. That would be the only thing, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. By the way, Representative Jewell, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions for Mr. Jackson? Okay. Representative Kelly, did you have any comments? I know you've been working closely with Mr. Jackson.
Just no, I support the CS, and I think the change worked out to Representative Olson's satisfaction. I think it kept us from a fiscal note and yet gave the fire teams what they wanted, which was that ability to make an early start. I guess that's a long comment for no, isn't it? Maybe I should say yes, Mr. Chairman. And so I think it accomplished everything by the end of the day, because when the fire teams are already on site, if you need to extend the season, you can do that because you're already manned up, you're already got your equipment in place, and you're ready to roll. So I really appreciated Representative Olson's office working to get us to that zero fiscal note that really and truly, I believe, has the potential of being just that.
Very good. We do have a representative from DNR online if we have questions for the DNR. Okay, any questions? For the record, welcome Representative Foster. Okay, why don't we go ahead and move Amendment 1.
You want me to object to it, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I'll move Amendment 1. You can object.
I'll object to it.
Okay, and this is just to make the title change, as Mr. Jackson has spoken to. Any objection? I'll remove my objection. Is there any other?
I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Move, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, is there any other objections? Okay, seeing none, Amendment 1 passes. Okay, any other discussion on the bill as amended? Okay, let's see. There is a zero fiscal note, as was mentioned. So if we're going to move this bill out of committee, make sure we include the zero fiscal debt. Is there a motion to move the bill out of committee?
That's 395?
Yes, sir.
HB 395, I'll move out of committee. Where the tax fiscal notes or Jennifer's recommendations.
As amended.
Okay. You want as amended.
As amended and the zero fiscal note.
And zero fiscal note.
Very good. Any objections?
Thank you, Chair.
Seeing no objections, bill passes out of committee. Thank you very much. Okay. Looks like a good bill coming up here. House Bill 394, insurance policies and core language. I'd ask Mr. Pulaski, who's my staff, to present the bill to us. Mr. Pulaski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Pulaski, and I'm an aide to Representative Meyer. House Bill 394 and the committee substitute from Labor and Commerce for House Bill 394 doesn't force anyone to do anything, but rather it removes an obstacle that prevents companies from serving the more than 80,000 Alaskans that currently speak a language other than English at home. The problem that exists in current statute is that there's no provision that would designate which version of an insurance policy or associated materials, like your advertising brochures or your other things that are published along with an insurance policy, is the official version. Without an official version in dispute, it's problematic for anyone trying to interpret it. So designating the official version as the English version allows companies to do what they want to do, to serve their customers in the state. HB 394 has a zero fiscal note, and essentially that's the bill, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Any questions?
Is the department going to testify on this?
The insurance department?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock. The Division of Insurance representative could not be here today, but there should have been a letter that was included in all of your packets expressing the division's support for the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I saw the letter, but they're not going to testify.
That's correct. Yeah, they're not on this to testify. They have been, but they have been supportive of the bill through the process.
My question is, Mr. Chairman, to the division through Mr. Pulaski, is why do we need this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, we do have a representative from the insurance industry here that could express the reason for the bill.
Yeah, we do have to testify Sheldon McWinters with State Farm, who will be testifying. Any other questions for the sponsor? Okay, thank you, Mr. Pulaski. Mr. Winters, if you want to please join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I represent State Farm. This is one of those win-win bills. The Division of Insurance supports it because it benefits the consumer, and the industry supports it because it allows us to provide a better product and thus tap into emerging markets of foreign language speaking consumers. In today's society, insurance permeates basically everything. We mandate that to drive a car, you have to have insurance. To buy a house, you basically have to have insurance, as you do if you're going to run any sort of business. As you probably all know, it's difficult enough to understand the English version of an insurance policy. If you speak English, it's basically impossible if foreign language is your primary language. What we want to do here is simply be able to provide better information about our insurance product to those foreign-speaking consumers so that they make wiser choices about their insurance decisions. So why do we need this bill? The answer is real simple. In Alaska, as in most states, court case law, when there is a dispute about the insurance contract, says something along those lines, that the court will look not only to the language of the insurance policy itself, but to any other extrinsic evidence. And of course, that runs the gamut from what your agent may have told you orally to something that somebody may have read in a brochure or seen on TV. This bill doesn't control all of that, but it simply addresses the concern that if we provide foreign language advertising or foreign language policy to these people, that the English version will control so long as we meet the two requirements. And that essentially is that we provide both versions, English and foreign language, in the same document, and we provide the disclosure in both versions that the English version controls in case of a dispute. The foreign language here is for your informational purposes. So that's the intent. It basically, I guess to put it in a nutshell, in those states where there is are similar provisions, there is much more foreign language advertising and information going out. In the states such as Alaska, where there is not this protection or assurance that some foreign language translation won't be used against you, there is little, if any, at all. And so we need that protection and want to get out the information to the consumer. If there's any questions, I'll try to answer them, but other than that, thank you for your consideration.
We do have some questions, but let me just make sure that the burden here is going to be on the insurance companies, because now you will have to provide, or you can provide, both English and Chinese or whatever your client wants. But the state is only concerned about the English version.
That, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Again, there's nothing right now that prohibits us from issuing foreign language advertising. We just want to, we would be more encouraged to do that and more willing to do that with this protection. And if we file anything with the Division of Insurance, an actual policy form, of course, it will be the English version with the foreign language there.
Okay, very good. Representative Warren.
Well, I'm glad to know that it will now be equally difficult for non-English readers to understand insurance policy. The question I had, though, is why do we need this bill? And what is it that now prohibits you under state law from providing the non-English version of an insurance policy to a policyholder?
Through the chair, Representative Warren, there is nothing that prohibits us from doing that except for the case law, the Supreme Court case law, that will indicate if we provide a foreign language version and that person relies on the foreign language version of a brochure, it is very likely that the Supreme Court would basically say if there's a dispute that the foreign language version controls. And so with that fear, insurance companies are reluctant to issue any sort of information in a foreign language for fear that it's going to be applied against them and misinterpreted.
Okay, just one follow-up.
Sure.
If there's a difference between a foreign language version of an insurance policy and an English version of an insurance policy, and the insured relies on the non-English version to their detriment, what version is going to control?
Through the chair, Representative Rywak, this law would state that the English version controls.
Even though, Mr. Chairman, I guess I apologize, I have more. Why then, if they can't read English and they're given an English and a non-English, would the English version control when they can't read it and they rely on what's the non-English version?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, I guess the basic intent is that without this provision, there won't be any foreign language version for them to read at all. So the idea is that we are giving them information in a foreign language that certainly they're going to use and rely on. There will be a disclaimer in there saying that this is for informational purposes. Of course, the English version controls. But the whole point of this bill is that without it, this foreign language person is not going to even have a foreign language translation. So, yes, the English version will control, even though the foreign language speaking person read the foreign language version.
So then I have a question then. If the court looks at all extrinsic evidence, is this then overriding that ruling to say, to the extent that there is extrinsic evidence that differs from the non-foreign language, you cannot consider that extrinsic evidence?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wyrock, I believe that, I don't know if I'd say it that strongly, but I believe that that is the direction of this statute, that the court would say. And of course, we need to remember that this only applies to documents where there is the English version right there for them to read if they can, the foreign language, and the disclosure in both foreign and English that folks read this at your peril because, and I shouldn't be not saying it accurately, but the English version controls.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Representative Joel. Thank you. I'm listening to your testimony and I'm looking at the bill. And what you're really talking about is not English.
Through the chair, Representative Joel. Yes, that's correct.
Because in this state, we have indigenous people I don't consider foreign. And I just wanted to clear that. Just because. And I know it's just dancing semantics here, but I think it's... I don't like to be considered foreign. However, some of the people are non-English speaking.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Joel, this bill did start with the term foreign language, and we did try to change to non-English, and I apologize if I'm still using the old term.
I know. Thank you.
What? I'm partially responsible here, Joe Ripson. Joel, I think my example started out with the person from China. So, okay.
And I understand, Mr. Chairman, that would probably more widely be the case. However, some of the indigenous languages are becoming written.
I understand. Okay. Any other questions, either for Mr. Pulaski or okay, Representative Kelly?
Where else are we doing this now? I'm new to the legislature, so where else have we plowed this ground for medical forms? And I can think of, I can get a dozen within a couple of minutes, probably. Where is this the first one, or is this the third one?
Okay. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative, I honestly don't know the answer to that.
And I don't either. This is the first time this has come up, as far as I know, Representative Kelly.
Okay. Will this be the first of many? I mean, I'm just concerned whether we're chaining up to another long list here or not.
I can't say. I'm not sure all industries will want to this extra effort here to provide two documents in two different languages. But
if I may comment through the chair. I don't think we're opening the floodgates here, and I say that only because the insurance arena is a little bit unique to other businesses in that the insurance contract is basically interpreted very strictly against the insurance companies by court law. And in a insurance dispute, you have this case precedence that says we're not just going to limit our review to the contract, which typically you do in most other arenas. But in the insurance arena, we're going to also look at extrinsic evidence, brochures, et cetera, and that is the problem. And I might also add that the insurance arena is just this issue of policies, and they are difficult to understand. We need to get out informational brochures to people.
Yeah. Sure, I'll get off of it, but it just seems to me, I won't try to out-lawyer Representative Wyrack, but he's not feeling as well as he has been. Maybe I do a reasonable job of it, but I'm worried about some of the same thing that I think he's scratching at there, and that is, let me ask it in reverse. If we do this and we fail to do it in other areas, does this change something that, for all practical purposes, to the average cat out there, English is the way we run the operation, and things will be generally construed in English. Does the fact that we've now fixed this one so very specifically mean that the medical folks now are somehow not doing as well as the insurance folks? I'm just curious. I don't have an answer for this, but it bothers me a little bit.
I don't know if you have a comment. Mr. Pulaski, you're welcome to join you. I guess I don't see the concern of Representative Kelly because the English, it's very clear English is still the dominant language here and the one that's going to be accepted by the state. But go ahead, either one of you guys.
If I may comment on that, and again, we need to keep in mind that we're not talking about advertising or a contract that is issued in only a foreign language. We are simply talking about the opportunity to provide either a policy form or a brochure in both English and foreign language for the information side. I don't know if that's being done in the medical profession or not, but that's at least somewhat unique to the insurance company.
And I'll get off. But I'm on a bank board. All kinds of things you hand out to folks. All kinds of people that are trying to accommodate folks of different that speak different languages. Here we say very specifically, but if you walk into the bank and they happen to create a Spanish version or whatever version tomorrow, you guys have said this is the one we'll use. They haven't yet. Are they now say, okay, we got another 100 lobbyists with something to do here. Might as well get on our way. And it bothers me. So I'm, Mr. Chairman, among the best bills I've ever seen, I do have a few problems with this.
I understand. Any other comments?
No.
Okay. Oh, yes.
Yeah, you just reminded me. This is one of the best bills I've ever seen. But, you know, I'm trying to think. I respect Representative Jewell's idea there, and he's certainly correct. I think the biggest problem is the influx of Vietnamese. There must be at least 50 to 100 of them. And they come from an old country. They're very educated and everything. They just can't read English, and they want insurance too. Some of them are very well to do in the last 30 years. I know one mechanic that used to work for me for 15 years. He must own probably 100 rentals right now, apartment rentals. That he rents out. I mean, these guys are professional guys. They don't say much, but you know, I'm sure that they'd be interested in. Not reading the fine print in English, and if they could read something in Vietnamese or something like that. As far as a lot of Yupiks and Inupiaks up in my area, they don't have access to that. I think most, for the most part, they're elders that can't read English. And if you're in a village, like if you're a clinic or something, they've got interpreters to help them, but it's not like they're signing a contract or something. I think this bill would fill it. A void that we're not seeing right now. And I think in Barrow, a lot of Filipino people up there. And these people are pretty hardworking people, and they're increasing their assets. You know, they're involved in their community. And I think maybe if this bill isn't all encompassing, I think maybe if other people would take the lead in education or not so much insurance. I used to buy a lot of insurance, for an air service. But anyway, I think this is a good start, this bill. It's one of the best bills I've ever seen.
Very good.
We come to praise the bill, not bury it. The fine point, though, I think, is from what I understand the testimony, correct me if I'm wrong, is not that we wouldn't do it. The insurance companies can already provide all this information on their own accord in every language in the world if they wanted to, and maybe they do. The point is it provides legal immunity if there's a distinction between the English version and the foreign version, and the foreign non-English version is relied upon to the detriment of the insured. That's what this bill does.
Anything else?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrick, the only other, I think, item that I'd put on point is that it also makes the policy call that knowingly misrepresenting the terms in a foreign language is a violation of the chapter.
Certainly.
And brings this in under all the other false advertising. So at the same time, you are trying to strike that balance between are you correctly translating to the best of your ability, but no translation will ever be perfect. And that's I think the dilemma that the companies are put in is that as close as you can ever get in a translation, it's never quite there. It's just the reality of different languages.
Representative Warburg, pondering?
No, I think that the insurance company is well aware that they want to avoid punitive damages, which would probably occur if there was knowing misrepresentation, which would be, they would no way they could potentially do. I think that would be, no one would ever accuse them of doing that. But it opens an area of discovery. What do they know? Why is it different? Who translated? What does it mean? You get an expert witness in a foreign, the non-English speaker, even English. You know, it just it's a nest for the insurance company. I'm sure they know it. And you know, one thing that may be a benefit, to the extent that you will promise to reduce the rates for another bill that benefits the insurance companies, I will put a due pass exclamation mark.
No comment.
Representative Kelly.
Just one question of Mr. Pulaski. Did you try at all to jump up on the higher issue of where this may occur in 1,000 spots and try to figure out, is there a way to say this in statute that just covers them all, or is that too risky?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, we didn't go that far. The discussions that we had was that I almost look at this actually, I think, in the inverse of the issue that you're bringing up, and I think it's more the actual statement of policy that English is the official version. It's not necessarily encouraging, but it's saying, as the state is concerned, English is the official version.
For insurance.
For insurance. Mm-hmm. So the larger issues of how, we didn't get into that because we, in the discussions we had, it was bringing it back to more the statement from our side that English was the official version. And so what are you doing to encourage other groups to operate in other languages?
Yeah, I agree. I think this actually solidifies that English is the dominant language and the one that's recognized by the state. But if the insurance companies want to put it in different languages, that's totally up to them.
It might, if I'm sure. The follow on to that is that if I were a banker now and a jillion other guys, I'd begin to possibly look out there and say that, okay, these guys have stated that it's official for here, which must mean that it isn't quite over here, and I probably better think about fixing it. Just a concern, I'm done.
Anything else? Is this still with Bill, Representative Foster, or have we discussed it?
Okay, I'll go ahead and move 8394 up. Committee with the attached list of notes with individual recommendations. I wanted to thank you for introducing myself.
Awesome. Okay, any objections? Seeing none, Bill passes. Thank you both for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Sheldon.
Shameless. Okay. Yes. Representative Rammer, you are next.
I did.
House Bill 321, the Honorable Representative Jay Rammer, Fairbanks, as trustee staff, and Jay Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, walking to finance today from our PPT hearings, I was thinking of from Wasilla to Fairbanks, from all over the state, corner to corner, Kotzebue down here in Juneau, Nome, about the...
You're going to love finance.
We're welcome to finance. It
sounds a little bit like a song about I can everywhere, man. You know.
Welcome to finance, Mr. Rammer.
You're
going to
love finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Seriously. We want to talk about the issue of drunk driving. This is an aggregated drunk driving bill, and I've kind of pitched it, and perhaps it's just a touch misleading. We've pitched it as double the BAC, double the jail limit, and I created somewhat of a misunderstanding with the rules chairman, so I want to try and clear that up today, and I'm going to turn it over to Jane, who's just worked very diligently and arduously on this with Suzanne from your office, Mr. Chairman, has done a great job also, I thank her. What we want to address is we've had the problem, and Representative Holm, Representative Kelly can speak to this, up in Fairbanks, we've just had a disproportionate amount of alcohol-related deaths, and we want to try and create a distinction between those that are drunk at a legal standard, and those that can't tell the difference between a stationary vehicle and a moving vehicle, between a traffic control signal, a stop sign, a traffic light, or a brake light on the car in front of them. And we are hoping to have an effect on human behavior. The fact is that the government has two tools at its disposal. One tool is a deterrent, and the second one is a criminal standard or a punishment phase once you've chose to ignore the deterrent. Presently, the deterrent is a blood alcohol content level of 0.08, and there are two different ways to arrive at a level of blood alcohol content that arrive at that take you over 0.08. Those two ways are either you're drinking to get intoxicated and you're not paying any attention to the penalties that are involved or to public safety, or secondly, you are trying to drink responsibly right up to that limit at which we hit 0.08 standard, and then you sit and stay where you are, you catch a ride, you drink a cup of coffee, you have a soft drink. And the standard that we want to try and create, Mr. Chairman, is an aggravated drunk driving. This is a point at which somebody has consumed so much alcohol that they know that they have passed the standard of you know, have I consumed enough to break the law or have I not? And we want to try and persuade those people to put their keys away. And the fact is that there are three deterrents to a person who is in consuming alcohol and thereby losing their judgment, because that's what law enforcement will tell you happens when people drink, is that the first thing that goes away is their judgment. And those three things are the jail time that everybody's familiar with, the fines and the forfeiture. And the third one, which ought to be foremost in people's minds, but never is, and that is that they could harm or kill somebody else. And we think that the greatest deterrent is the jail time component. And right now, we have a single standard for measuring a drunk driver. And if you think about the criminal standards that judiciary and sometimes this committee has to wrestle with, there's shoplifting is breaking the law. Robbing a convenience store without a handgun is breaking the law. Robbing a convenience store with a handgun is breaking the law. And robbing a bank is breaking the law. But all four of those crimes would enjoy a different standard under our current judicial system. And we don't have that kind of standard with drunk driving. We really have a single standard right now, which is just a 0.08 standard. And so we want to create an elevated standard that is 0.16 or greater, that you would be subject to double the jail fine. And this would apply in particular to the first offense and the second offense, so that instead of a weekend in jail, it would be more akin to a week or 6 days, and the same thing for a second offense. And although there are some increases for a third, fourth, and fifth DUIs, what we are hopeful of, and what evidence in other states has shown, is that having a longer jail time seems to have a positive effect on reducing recidivism, and that's what we want to do. Once we're into felony drunk drivers, then they really have declined any help, and they're a menace to society. And in long conversations with the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles, Dwayne Bannon, he says that the suspension of a license provision has reached the ridiculous. You know, first you're suspended for 90 days, and then for a year, and then for 5 years. But inevitably, a habitual drunk driver is drinking and driving on a suspended license, and they're still drinking and driving until their license has been taken away for 125 years, and they're still out there doing it. And we think that with younger people, who are still wrestling with the severity of the drunk driving laws, that to address this by doubling the jail time is a compelling feature which may make our roads safer by requiring people to think a little more carefully before take their keys and get in their vehicles when they're really intoxicated. As this bill was winding through House Judiciary, and I'd be remiss not to bring this to your attention, Representative Coghill, who I respect and admire very much, the question that he posed is, if you double the drunk driving penalty, because it does generate a $1.2 million fiscal note to do this, if you double the penalty, are you going to change the behavior of the drunk driver, or are you going to change the behavior of the state of Alaska in the manner in which they choose to deal with this drunk driver? And I'm as mindful as anybody on this committee that we're trying to hold down the rise in costs of government and not contribute to them. So we prepared a repealer, a CS with a repealer in it that would allow us to have this enforced for several years so that we could measure whether it had a positive effect on reducing some of our drunk driving numbers along with some of our other measures. Conferring in our office and visiting with Suzanne Cunningham, we've decided not to offer the CS today and to offer the version of this bill that came out of House Judiciary, but to allow you to be mindful of our concerns that if this isn't going to work, then some years from now, when hopefully I'll still be here and some of the other members will be here, then we can look to strip out this provision. But my belief is that this is the most meaningful deterrent that exists for public for the benefit of public safety, which is people don't want to go to jail, and the DUI, insofar as the jail component, has been really compressed into people thinking they now get to go to jail over a weekend, and we would like to build into the public lexicon the nature that it's 6 days. 6 days is a long time to spend isolated or at a North Star facility or a halfway house or some kind of a holding center. And so with that, I'd like to open up to questions for the committee or turn it over to Jane, and then we have some people from Corrections and Department of Law that would like to help out. The other benefit that I will I'll leave you with is that this also catches problem drinkers at the moment of crisis, which is when they've been arrested and they have to contend with the jail component, and it may be the kind of incentive that gets them into the therapeutic courts, which we're working on trying to bring to Fairbanks, which are working in Anchorage, and we've just got to end up with safer streets and value that against the cost. So with that, I'll open up to questions or pass it over to Jane Pearson so that she can address more specifics in this bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Remmers. Did you want to make some comments, Ms. Pearson, or are you just available for questions?
I'll answer questions.
Okay, great. Is there any questions?
This applies to bush pilots, too?
I think the answer is yes.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Representative Kelly.
Just to, as you know, I tend to support this, and yet we see each other at MAD meetings. I hadn't been to one before I ran for office. And how did they come out of this? I mean, I remember initially there was some problem, and that's not necessarily going to be the only factor in whether it makes sense, but how did you come out on that?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, thank you for asking the question. This bill enjoys the support of Mothers Against Drunk Drivers on one side and the CHAR group on the other side, and it's often difficult to bring those two groups to align on anything. I will say that locally, that the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers were opposed to this for precisely the same reason that our friend Representative Guerra has a problem with this, and that is to try to draw a standard between drunk and really drunk, and he's afraid that if you draw the standard to really drunk, then you're saying to people that are at the minimum standard of 0.08, oh, well, we don't, it's not so severe, we don't mind. But I think it's when the MAD folks started to get letters and support from MAD chapters across the country telling them that this is an excellent step to fight alcoholism, this high-risk operation of a motor vehicle, aggravated drunk driving, however you want to frame it. And then the mad people became supporters of it. But as is often the case, sometimes you have to be pulled or pushed to support something. And that was the case with both of these support groups. I went to the CHAR convention in Kodiak and said, you know, why don't you support something reasonable, like safer streets and responsible consumption of alcohol, instead of always bringing it right down to Super Lotto and video poker. And the CHAR people came on board over that, and the MAD people came on when they found support from other national chapters of MAD.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Rusty at home.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome.
Thank you.
My seatmate.
Sir.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I didn't see anything in the data that you presented that showed any reductions in DUIs based upon, you may have it someplace here, but I didn't see it, based upon the change from having a 0.08 to having a super high rate of 0.15 or 0.18 and 0.20 in all these other states. Do you have any empirical data that says that it is really contributed to the reduction of folks drinking and driving?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that was one of the difficulties that we had House Judiciary. The states referred to it as something that they believed contributed to a lesser degree of recidivism, but the information was anecdotal in nature. And that was precisely what prompted Representative Coghill to ask this question of, does it change the behavior of the drinker, or does it change the behavior of the way the state deals with the drinker? And we wrestled with that, which is why we prepared the CS to put a repealer in it, because we thought, well, let's try and judge it empirically over the next 3 years. And then with some ensuing dialogue, we decided better just to leave it in there and be mindful of that, and try to use the information that we get from corrections and law enforcement over the next couple of years to be mindful of whether it works for us. Because we are actually seeing, with the laws that we've put in place here in Alaska, we're seeing fewer DWIs, which suggests that we have safer roads, and that we think this would be another reasonable step in getting to a safer and safer place. Go ahead.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, one of the facts that we do know through the studies is that people stopped with a higher BAC are more likely to recidivate than lower BAC people, whether that's because they're prone to have more problems with alcohol. So that is aimed at hitting that group of people.
But you were through the chair again, Representative Holm, you're right on that twitch point. That's exactly what Representative Coghill stumbled on, and we are also. So I would, encourage probably Representative Foster, because you've got the best institutional memory, you know, here, or Representative Stoltz would be here. I would encourage the committee to pass this, to support it when it comes to the floor, and then let's flag this thing 2 years from now or 3 years from now, and let's see if it contributed, if it worked. Even if we have the same amount of DUIs, if we find that we have DUIs that are at 0.08, so we have people that, you know, they drank, they went beyond the criminal standard, but it's the people that are statistically causing the fatalities and many, many of the accidents, and this is when you start to be politically incorrect with the MAD groups, it's the people that can't see a moving, a stationary vehicle from a moving vehicle, a taillight from a stop sign, from a traffic light. And that's what we want to try and address. I just keep trying to look for common sense solutions to try and make our streets safer without going into prohibitionism, and, you know, without going down to 0.06, so that if you have a drink and a half, you've now hit a legal standard. That a big problem is that people get really drunk, and then they still choose to drive. And we don't have a standard that covers them that's any more severe than if you go to a lawn party this summer and get into a vehicle after you've had 3 1/4 drinks, and it wasn't your intent to drive. You're judged at the same standard as the guy who sat in a 12-pack and then, you know, made a very belligerent a step and a very irresponsible, irrational step to get in an operated motor vehicle then.
Go ahead, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you very much for that very insightful group of comments. But I guess the reason I look at this, you know, that our job here in the Finance Committee is to look at the fiscal notes. And when I look at the fiscal note here, the fiscal note doesn't indicate to me that there's going to be any significant change, either up or down. It's on a straight line. And so, or it's in an indeterminate mode. And I guess my hope would be that somebody in corrections who would believe that they would have less expenses further down the line than they do today, if in fact it's true that we're going to get less and less people committing those acts. So I hope you're right. I think it's the right thing to do, but we shall see.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holman. Just to let committee members know, my intent is to take public testimony on this and have the discussion with the sponsor, but to hold the bill so that we can look at ways to somehow reduce this fiscal bill, because I would agree with you, Representative Holman. It's quite large.
Yes, sir.
Representative Hawker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You testified a couple of times here in the last few minutes that this is all about separating drunk from really drunk. And we determined that drunk is this 0.08 and then really drunk is 0.16. Is there any objective scientific evidence, physiological basis for those numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, again, this is one of the things that we struggled with in House Judiciary is Representative Garris. Representative Garris said, well, what's the difference between 0.159 and 0.16? What makes 0.16 drunker? I mean, you could see it was this interesting things that we're trying to wrestle with. There is a in the transportation bill in Congressman Young's transportation bill, there are federal funds available that address high DAC drinkers and there is a component to offer federal funds. However, you had to fulfill other components that included roadblocks and checkpoints and things that in Alaska just wouldn't play well, that just is beyond what we are willing to accept because of our individual liberties that we regard even more highly. But it is generally recognized across the country that a high DAC limit, and is recognized by the states, and I think, again, there are about 31 states that have adopted a high blood alcohol content standard. And that standard generally is between 0.15 and 0.22. So from our point of view, we chose 0.16 because it's, again, government, one of the great tools the government has is the baseball bat as a deterrent. And it's very easy to spread as a public message, double the BAC, you're going to go to jail for double the time. Double the BAC, double the jail time. And we think that will enter the language of how this law is expressed and enforced as it enters, if it should go into effect. And so for that reason, we chose 0.16 rather than 0.15 rather than 0.22, but all 31 of those states have a standard between 0.15 and 0.22, and that's the same standard that's referenced in the National TILA Transportation Bill.
Okay, so 0.15 to 0.22 is, I for one, I'll be honest with you, I mean, the state of Alaska was blackmailed by the federal government into the 0.08 standard.
Yes.
I am adamantly opposed to the 0.08 standard, but we were blackmailed into it. Yeah. I just likewise here by that same argument says, well, let's just double the rate. We've compounded the double the problem. 0.16 is no less or no more judge, you know, just a judgment. And that's particularly troublesome to me. And then I'm curious, you know, as far as the taking of these measurements, what's the error, the tolerance for error in the measurement process?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I think that somebody from Department of Law, Corrections, or Public Safety would better address that. I suspect that it's the same thing as the what do they call the machine, the blood alcohol data master, would judge it. It would address the same thing. Although I think that our bill does a refusal does result in the same thing as a high risk BAC, and we do have a problem with people that are ingesting methamphetamine or smoking marijuana, where it's difficult to otherwise judge their impairment. And I think there may be some ancillary benefits that come from from the ability not to allow for a refusal now as a higher standard than it would be previously.
Okay, so what I heard is we don't know what the error tolerance in the measurement process is.
No, not for me.
And then so another approach to this, we're making some very arbitrary decisions, 0.08, 0.16, 0.16, and I'm Megan, you mentioned it yourself, 0.159, 0.161.
Yes.
Around the margins, we're making a substantial, it's an incredibly judgmental decision we're making with extremely significant consequences to an individual. In previous testimony, explaining what is really at issue here are stupid people hurting innocent people.
Yes.
Did you contemplate taking a look at adding, rather than trying to create this drunk and really drunk on a totally judgmental, non-empirical standard, and look more at saying, putting in an aggravator factor of having actually injured someone, or being involved in an accident, or being involved in a fatality? Why don't we put some, hugely inflate the aggravators?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, on point one, those penalties already exist, and on the second point, with all due respect, Representative Hawker, we're taking testimony in room 124 right now that you can say we're doing the same thing, that these are incredibly subjective, arbitrary figures that we're attaching to how we want to. I mean, you're making the same argument that Conoco, BP, and Exxon are making about our taxing mechanism down there. So I think you're looking for a right number.
We're not putting people in jail here, sir. We're not talking about taxing an industry. There is a substantial difference.
Okay. Yeah, let's stay on this bill.
Yes, sir.
Anything else?
No, sir.
Okay. Representative Weirach.
Oh, I just... were you inviting a sunset of January 1, 2009?
I think, through the chair, Representative Weirach, I believe so. So we wanted to go about 3 years to see whether this contributed to greater public safety.
Okay. Okay. Got Representative Jewell, but he's talking to Representative Kelly.
Just a quick question. As we had the epidemic in Fairbanks, the deaths that got everyone's attention statewide, but particularly back home, we began to look at the question of how we might take action here. So we came down here, and there were five different approaches. 15 started out on the blackboard and boiled down to five or something. Is this the one that you came to? To the exclusion of others, or do you see others that you think fit in? I mean, I was in the same room as you when we heard Judge Steinkruger say the therapeutic courts, which I had come to think had some real attractiveness based on their success rate. And she said, the other guy said we can do 50. I tell you, we can't do more than 20. Well, I don't like those numbers for the cost. And I was very discouraged when I walked out of that room that night, as you may have been. Is this the one that we need to pick this year, and or are there others out there as well that you're looking at?
And through the chair, Representative Kelly, MAB is not impressed with this as a deterrent. It's far too tame for their agenda. Their agenda is an aggressive neo-prohibitionist agenda. They are tolerant prohibitionists, and most of their measures reflect that of a tolerant prohibitionist. And so they zoomed right past this, and they want a 0.02 for a legal standard. They want to put people in jail for a year. They want to drop the European standard. This is a yawn for them. But I think that really what we're targeting are those people that have consumed a great deal of alcohol, who demonstrate great impairment in judgment, in walking, in motor skills behind the wheel of a vehicle, and are causing a great deal of the physical harm and fatalities in our state. At no time have they been impressed with this it's one of many things that they would like to see. But to me, as somebody who is in the industry, who operates two beverage dispensary licenses and two restaurant eating place licenses, and I have seen people overserved, not at our establishment, generally speaking, but I've seen people come into our establishment already in an overserved condition from wherever they were previously, I've seen people that we've taken keys away from and called cabs for, and then they pull out the secret set of keys that they have in their pocket because they don't want to surrender their vehicle as though it's an appendage, and so we think that this is a measured and appropriate way to address people that have consumed a great deal of alcohol. 0.16 is pretty liquored up.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Representative Kelly. Representative Jewell.
You mentioned how a person might come in from maybe not your establishment, but a different establishment. Just wondering whether or not there's a civil liability attached to that if they're moving from establishment to establishment and something happens, and let's say you are the last server. Mm-hmm. Is there a civil liability that's attached to you?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, there is, and that already exists, and it's a hazard that anybody in that industry chooses. I will tell you, we were talking about this issue to a bartender at the Triangle here in Juneau. She said that she had somebody who appeared sober come in, ordered a shot of liquor and a bottle of Heineken. She's a CAMS trained server. She served them, thought they were sober. They did the shot. They took a sip of beer. Their forehead went into the bar top, and they passed out dead drunk at the bar. This is obviously a habitual drinker and oftentimes habitual drinkers can appear sober when they walk into an establishment, and that's the risk that we run. But there are a lot of other newer drinkers, younger people, age 16 to 34, and I use the age 16 to intentionally that are wrestling with how to use alcohol responsibly, and I think that that's the age group we want to get to. People that are in their mid 30s and headed toward the second half of their lives. You know, these are habitual drinkers, and I don't think that this aggravated drunk driving bill really is designed for them. I think we're trying to get to people before they reach that point. At that point, it's just a deterrent to put dangerous people in jail for a little bit longer. So good to me.
Diet Coke, right?
Yes, sir.
Representative, was there anything else?
So the answer to that was yes.
Through the chair, Representative Julia, we already have that. We already have that risk.
Thank you.
Took a while to get there, but yeah, the answer is yes. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Chair. I thought you might know, and maybe I, just for my interest, and maybe for all of our education. Do you know what causes BAC and how the alcohol consumption affects different people with regards to weight, age, height, and is 0.08 in your analysis, is 0.08 or 0.16 a definitive, whether it be to a female drinking or a man drinking or a 40-year-old having two beers or three beers? How many? What constitutes 0.08 and is it the same for everybody? And if not, why not? And And are we just arbitrarily just throwing numbers up? Because I remember some time ago, I think Representative Hawker makes a very good point. We were at 0.12, and then we were at 0.1, and then we were at 0.08, and there's been, it's kind of like our carbon monoxide problems in Fairbanks, where nobody has any data, but they just keep punching us. And I wonder, I don't drink, so mock's next to me, but I'm concerned if it's one or two beers at 0.08, it's three or four beers at 0.1 or 1.6, and I don't know if it is or isn't, I have no idea. At what point in time is somebody non-compos mentis to where they can't drive? I know many truck drivers and many guys in years past, they could drink a fifth of whiskey and they could drive home, and you wouldn't know.
Right.
And that doesn't mean they were capable by any stretch of the imagination, but they were. What did you call them a minute ago? You said that they were mature drinkers or
habitual.
Habitual, I guess that's a good word too. So I guess my question is, does the average citizen, when he goes out and has two or three glasses of wine, is he all of a sudden, we had a case in Fairbanks where a guy claimed he didn't have very much, but he still blew over the amount? How do we function like this? When you pass laws that just have a, you know, because this is a drop-dead number. And I'm concerned that we don't put people in jail for long periods of time if we do, for the wrong reason.
Through the chair, Representative Hull, some people drive as well at 75 miles an hour as they do at 55. I also fought the 0.10 standard. I thought it was unfair. I accept the 0.08 standard because it's the law of the land, but I will tell you, I've had the measurements explained to me, and Jane can do that, but I'll tell you that at 0.16, everybody in this room would know that they were severely impaired and should not be operating a motor vehicle. You might be a whole lot of fun walking. We might be able to tell some great jokes in the bar, but you should not be operating a motor vehicle or any kind of a sharp mechanized instrument.
Like an airplane.
Or a boat, yeah. Or a car, or a chainsaw.
Yeah.
But I'll let Jane explain the science of how it works.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, we actually did a little bit of this yesterday. We were playing around with it on the computer, and there is something called a drink wheel.
A drink wheel.
All
right. So like a color wheel.
Like a color wheel, yeah. And we put in, one of the girls in the office is 120 pounds, and we put her in, and she could have two drinks, basically a drink an hour, two drinks in 2 hours. And over that, she would show above a 0.08. Of course, this is a general thing, generally on somebody's weight, and not, you know, individual, because there can always be variables.
One beer per hour?
One beer per hour.
You ever been in a bar?
Yeah, I'm recovering alcoholic myself, but yeah. I'll tell you, I don't think I could have driven below a 0.10 when I was drinking or functioning. So, you know, a 175-pound man was three drinks in 3 hours, and so it really is a pretty low standard.
Okay, any other questions for the sponsor? Okay, see none. Let's see. I don't think we have anybody to testify. I think these folks are just online for questions, but let me make sure. Quinlan Steiner?
Hello?
Yes, Quinlan, did you want to testify, sir?
No, I didn't have any testimony or position on the bill. I was just available for questions on the fiscal note that we put in, which was indeterminate.
Okay, very good. And Josh Fink, do you do the same? Josh Fink?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I was just available for questions on the OPA's indeterminate fiscal note as well. I did not have any testimony.
All righty. Okay. Is there any questions on the fiscal notes as we know them right now? Okay, no, don't see any questions on the fiscal notes as of right now, and or any more questions concerning the bill itself. So let's hold this bill aside. My staff is available for amendments if you want to make amendments to this bill. Or,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I was just talking to Portia with the Department of Corrections back. We're going to check with the state troopers to find out whether that's a good standard for consuming alcohol. It seems like the drinking wheel on the computer might rough judgment, pretty aggressive judgment. So we're going to try and get with law enforcement and public safety and try and get a more accurate read on that for when you bring the bill back up.
Go ahead, Rich.
Just to comment on that, I think the numbers were very different from the MAD numbers that I was given. Very, very different. So I appreciate what you're saying.
Thank you, Mr.
Hold on, Representative. Representative Jewell?
Just a question. Have you looked into I just now remembered somewhere when you there's a device somewhere, I guess, that exists when you jump into your car, you breathe into it. I don't know what it's called.
Ignition internal.
That
ignition
that internal. Exists?
Yes.
Okay. I'll think about it between now and the next.
Yes, sir.
Right. Have you looked into that? You have information on that you could share with us?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, we have, but it's hard to have a standard. It's something that you can enforce in urban areas that you can't enforce in rural areas. It's not fair to all Alaskans, and there are a lot of real operational difficulties with one of those things. It shuts down your car, you got to get somebody out to reset it. It's a really, it's an imperfect science. It's an imperfect solution. It doesn't quite address the same issue that we're trying to focus in on here, which is high-risk drunk drivers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Rivers. Actually, Representative Rivers, next meeting we'll be having with your committee resources. Next committee is Monday. Next, I think the resources meeting here tomorrow, so we won't be.
On that 0.16 and testifying, we'll see what it looks like.
Yeah, that's great.
You got it.
Yeah, you can do that, Representative. Just like a live model. Okay, thank you. Tomorrow, like I said, the House Resources is going to be meeting in this room. And then our next meeting will be Monday, March 6th. We'll be meeting jointly with House Resources to meet with our legislative consultants concerning PPT. So we don't have a meeting tomorrow. I'm sure you could join the resources group if you want to tomorrow. But we do have a joint meeting on Monday. So what we're going to do on Tuesday, and I hope this doesn't mess up your schedules too much, we'd like to have a meeting at 9 o'clock on Tuesday, again at 1:30. And at 9 o'clock, we have several bills. At 9 o'clock, House Bill 399, Elder Fraud and Assistance. House Bill 400, Confiscation of Firearms. House Bill 441, Therapeutic Courts for DUI Sentencing. And then in the afternoon, I'm bringing back up House Bill 324 and also House Bill 408 that wasn't ready. We were supposed to hear the other day. And then bring back Senate Bill 218, Criminal Sentencing and Polygraphs. So that's on Tuesday. We'll meet in the morning and the afternoon. And then hopefully Wednesday we'll just meet in the afternoon. And that will be all for next week. Any questions?
I appreciate knowing in advance all the bills. That's great. Thank you.
Okay, anything else to come for committee at this time? No, we're adjourned.